Yeah, it's recording anyway.
Perfect. Well, it's great to see you, and it's great to be able to speak to you live.
Yeah, great.
And in real time. It's almost like we're in the same room here.
Absolutely.
But David, I read the article that you've written about the protests in Portland, and I find it very, very, very interesting. And it stimulated a few thoughts and ideas in my mind in and around. Why has that protest been so successful in that that's been consecutive for, I don't know, 50 or 52 or 55 nights?
So yeah, it keeps on building.
It does it all right, excellent, because
I mean, it was not always constant, but it was I think it kept on going, and I mean, they say it was getting smaller, but I think it was going in waves, depending on a lot of factors. Okay. But one of the things that kept on, I mean, it was, for one thing, it was police response was terrible. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, so that tended to get a lot of people angry and get a lot more people into the streets after a whole bunch of people got tear gassed. That was one factor, I think. Another factor was every time some new lynching occurred somewhere else in the country, you know, carried out by police or whatever, that tended to get into the news around here and then, you know, piss people off more, as it did elsewhere. That was one factor. Another was people, certain elements had the goal of taking over police stations like they did in Minneapolis and Seattle. And so there was, some element that would never be happy until they could take the police station over, you know, so that's kind of a high bar, but it keeps the street fighting going, you know, because if you don't get what your goal is, if the goal is to actually get the police to flee and take over the station, that's a pretty high bar. And, you know, it happened in a couple of situations in Minneapolis and in Seattle, you know, fairly early on after the George Floyd killing. But it didn't get repeated elsewhere, as far as I know, you know, that sort of abandonment of the police stations.
Okay. What do you think? Obviously, there's been like a lot. It's not a revolution in inverted commas, but there's a catalyst. The latest catalyst was the murder of George Floyd. But is this fitting in with a wider context of what's happening in America and a broader expanse throughout the world? There seems to be a push, certainly in different political arenas throughout the world, there appears to be a push away from neoliberal austerity, with people not necessarily embracing socialism, but they're looking for a change. They're looking for some form of an antidote to, you know, minimum wage, homelessness, lack of social housing, lack of a proper security network for people's welfare benefits. Are we just scratching the surface of a whole kind of beneath the surface anxiety that's kind of another pandemic across the world?
I think, it's contentious, and I think it depends on who you ask and what kind of answer you'll get to that question, because I think there are certain folks that would feel that anything that's taking attention away from the issue of institutional racism and police mm-hmm. violence and lynchings against Black people is sort of like, distracting in a way. And I can see where people are coming from when they're talking about that, but and definitely this uprising was set off by the lynching of George Floyd, but also what's been happening, and you hear it coming from so many different quarters of radical Black intellectuals like Cornel West and the minister who's heads the. The group, there was a Poor People's Economic Rights, Economic Human Rights Campaign, all kinds of people amplifying, the head of the AME Church, the African Methodist Church in Seattle, you know, all kinds of people making the connection that, well, if like the asking the if then statements, like if Black Lives Matter, then what about affordable housing? If Black Lives Matter, then, you know, what about the education not being funded by except by local taxes? So it's ensuring that education is always a sort of an apartheid system in this country. Asking all kinds of questions, like, if Black Lives Matter, why is Cancer Alley in Louisiana around all the oil drilling industry? Why is it so completely full of Black people? I mean, why do Black people live in the most polluted neighborhoods? I mean, you know, asking these questions, and then it naturally causes anybody with a brain to start making serious analysis about the capitalist system, along with institutional racism, because these things are very, very intimately tied together. And it's very, very obvious, I think, to increasing numbers of people from across the board that trying to undo institutional racism in the context of a cutthroat capitalist system that has been using racism as a tool to divide people for centuries and has continued to do that. I mean, it's not working. You know, they're not going to solve the problem. And they continue to exacerbate the problem. In fact, the ruling class, in so many different ways, they continue the problem. It's still real. And, you know, they're still imprisoning, you know, two-thirds of the people in prison are people of color. And, you know, the statistics, 87% of people who work in slaughterhouses are people of color in this country. You know, it's just, it's an apartheid state in so many ways. And it's not all about race. There's loads of poor white people as well. But the thing is that people are making these connections all over the place. So I think what's happening, and maybe from the very beginning, is the basic aspects of the whole structure of the society and are being questioned in all kinds of different ways. So I'd say, you know, it's often being called intersectional. It's certainly multiracial, but it's a very broad kind of thing that's starting to happen. Although I think in terms of where it might be going, you know, it's anybody's guess, but definitely there's lots of common talk about things like defunding the police and that is
the military.
Defunding the military. And it's very clear that the people in power, you know, in the states and most cities, and certainly in the federal government, have no interest in defunding police or defunding the military. And in fact, they just passed the biggest military budget ever in the history of the world last week.
On top of the biggest one the previous year. I was just reading that.
Which was the biggest in the history of the world. Yeah.
America's their military expenditures at 35% of the total of the
37% last. I just looked it up yesterday. 37%, according to whatever Google, whatever the source was on top, 37%.
I saw 35% earlier. So there's a couple of questions come out of this. One of them is there a political manifesto from Black Lives Matter? Now, I understand that the people on the street are protesting about the police brutality and institutional racism in America. But is there a political manifesto to come out of this? Is there? I'm surprised they're not running a third party candidate. I'm surprised they didn't take Philanese Floyd, George's brother, and run him as a Black third party presidential candidate, because Biden, for me, is not a proper he's not a real contender against Trump. So while you have this duopoly of the Republicans and the Democrats, who are both capitalist elitist parties bought by the corporations, there'll be no change on the ground for anybody, regardless of their race, color, religion in America. So where's it all going to go? It can't just be street protest without a political agenda manifesto to carry through the changes they want to see in government? Or would it be your opinion that maybe a revolution, another American revolution, is maybe the only way to change the status quo?
Well, I mean, I think there's so many different potential ways to influence governments, and we can see that around the world. I'm just taking very recent examples. I mean, I think it's been written about in the mainstream press a lot that the Gilets Jaunes, that the Yellow Vest movement in France, has done more to cause the state to make concessions to the interests of in the interests of the working class. They've done more than the labor movement has in decades. And I don't remember the specifics, but it seemed to be something that a lot of journalists were saying. And it's, I think the same can be said
about the labor movement in some respects is part of the establishment. That's how I view it here. I'm a trade union supporter, but I believe that in some level it's all interconnected, and there's no real a bit like the false thing around politics, the false bosses and trade unions, that people are in comfortable positions, don't want to rock the boat, the people aren't going to come out on strike, so you know, negotiate for the best deal you can get from the employer. But I don't see any real radicalism within the trade union movement, and there's the right wing of the trade union as well, people that are just self-protectionists. But I'd love to actually see what the Yellow Vests have done. I know Macron had the back down around some stuff about, I think it was pensions and the retirement age.
Right.
A year now,
which was a big deal, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, here in the U.S., I think it's a lot of people would say, like the reforms of the 1930s and the New Deal, they get talked about a lot in terms of Roosevelt's progressivism.
The Wall Street crash then and the huge unemployment, the Dust Bowl.
Exactly. That's the thing. It's like that kind of what you saw with this big $3 trillion bailout, which was mostly a corporate bailout, but still, the thing was that it was bipartisan, and the reason why there was bipartisan support for this kind of massive government spending, just as in the 30s, was because of the circumstances, but also not just the circumstances, but what were those circumstances? Not just the crash of the stock market and the sudden, you know, the loss of work for so many people and the economic situation, but the response to that by the people, which was to organize and to have massive rallies, to organize unemployed workers councils. They were evicting people so much that they had to ban evictions altogether in the city of Chicago. You know, so there was this kind of resistance going on in the streets, which led the government. I mean, in 1931, I remember reading in Zinn's People's History of the U.S., it stuck with me. In 1931, just in that one year alone, there were 500 different incidences of more than 100 armed people liberating warehouses of their contents, you know, in different parts of the country. Like that was the atmosphere, you know. So it was a sort of a scary situation for the ruling class. But I think as sort of like people might say the same about the riots that you might, you know, that they've been characterized as riots anyway in the media after the killing of George Floyd that occurred in cities throughout the country, where including in Portland. If you go to downtown Portland, you'll see that most of it is boarded up and destroyed, you know, but and that's true of many different cities in this country. And to me, it's like generally, you know, actually living in the context of a country where that's becoming so much more divided between the rich and the poor, where my own rent has gone up by 250% in the past, you know, since I've lived in Portland. It's this the kind of untenable situation. I think there's a lot of people who feel really good about seeing all those corporate stores smashed up. You know, it's just a lot of people aren't shedding any tears about it, and they feel actually it's therapeutic. And I think the people destroying all those stores, it was a wide variety of people, not just the usual black bloc. And they couldn't say this was outside agitators, you know, because it was happening everywhere at the same time. You know, it was a lot of people doing it. It was really quite a cross section, young, very much tending towards the youth, but otherwise quite a cross section of society. And then that scared the ruling class for sure, regardless of whether the demands were clear, you know, and they're not going to defund the police, but they are probably going to extend a whole lot of moratoriums on evictions, you know, and other kinds of reform. They're going to send more money to people, you know, it won't be enough. And you know, whether it's going to be enough to you know, really change people's lives for the better, or fend off chaos, or potentially all kinds of movements that the ruling class will feel very threatened by. You know, who knows what the future holds, but they're scared for sure, because you can't just have, we're looking at 28 million evictions between now and September, and you could see that multiracial crowds of people just trashed the centers of most of the major cities in the country, you know, at the end of last May. So it's a message to them, and they've been responding in their own ham-handed ways, in their own kleptocratic ways, of course, handing like what 10 to something like 90% of the trillion of the multi-trillion dollar bail, it really goes to corporations, you know. But you know, it was, as that still leaves quite a bit that went to, you know, our bank accounts and went to this unemployment scheme that has really been, you know, keeping tens of millions of people alive, and now it's going to expire at the end of this month, like what, in 2 days. So who knows what's next? The unemployment.
Yeah. Well, I assume that the ruler class will do what they always do. They'll give just enough to enough people to prevent a real kind of upswelling of the working class or a revolution. I think you could legitimately claim that the majority of people involved in the revolution are the people of no property, the people who have got to the point where they have nothing left to lose except potentially their liberty and their lives. And that's why a lot of governments would subsidize basic food staples like bread and milk and things. So as a parent, if you can feed your children and try and put a roof over their heads, then that's that's a responsibility that you take on board. But what I'm really thinking about now is how things go forward. I mean, the Black Lives Matter movement, I think they'll struggle to continue every night to come out and protest and protest and protest, especially as people are arrested and people start being fed through the judicial system and the prison system and perhaps huge fines. And I read today that some of the bail conditions around people who've been arrested is that they can no longer attend any protests going forward. And then there's the police, military, governmental, presidential response. So, I mean, are we witnessing the birth of a fascist state where they're sending the military onto the streets to kidnap people and put them in unmarked vehicles and take them to, well, I mean, what about, we're going to start heading towards detention centers or concentration camps, or if the jails begin to fill up, I mean, where will it put the excess people? So can a Black Slave movement continue in its present state, which from someone outside is protest without result? It appears to be protest for the sake of protest, because there is no tangible result from the protest itself. And will the government, which has militarized the police over the last decade, just send in the cops, send in the military, and you've got like a low warfare, a low civil war between one aspect of the citizens and one aspect of the government? And it doesn't sound good for the next 10 or 15 years going forward for people aged 15 to 30 to be arrested, given a custodial sentence, or to have this have a criminal record, on inverted commas, for taking on the state. It's where will it all go? That's the $64,000 equation.
Yeah, it's really unknown at this point. And it's, of course, you know, you got this movement is happening at a time when you know, it's probably fair to say that a very large number, a percentage of the people participating in it are unemployed, you know, because there's suddenly we have 30 million newly unemployed people in this country, you know, and then at the same time, they've been stuck at home, you know, trying to be doing the lockdown pandemic thing. And, you know, so there's all these other factors going on. People don't know what the future holds. They're unemployed and they have time on their hands, and maybe even a little money, but the money's about to run out. You know, it's and they've been stuck in isolation, and now they're getting a lot of camaraderie at protests. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in terms of the in terms of any kind of things being won, it definitely what's going on at the municipal level all over the country, and to some extent at the state level, depending on the state, to varying degrees, is actual reforms that are where sometimes police budgets are being reduced, and the money is being set, put in to other kinds of areas. So it's nothing impressive, but I mean, it would be unfair to say that there's no results in terms of like, there's definitely been the conversation has changed in a way that is really quite something to hear, at least in terms of when you listen to the, you know, public or mainstream or corporate press, they are talking about a lot of things in different ways. Rather than saying things like protesters allege that Christopher Columbus, killed a lot of people and held slaves, you know, it's talked about differently. Now on CNN, they'll say Christopher Columbus, who colonized the country and killed a lot of people and held slaves, you know, they just talk about it as a fact, you know, the racist history of this country, you know, they'll talk about that as a fact now, not like some people allege the country has a racist history, you know. So I mean, it seems kind of minor, these kinds of changes in a way, and maybe it is, but the conversation is being affected, and so to some extent laws are being affected, but it's too early to tell, you know, where this is going. Or but, you know, one thing that's there's definitely progressive groups, like Black-led progressive groups, that are making a lot of demands of legislatures at various levels that are being listened to much more than they would have been a few months ago. But then at the same time, you know, we're in the midst of a pandemic that is affecting Black and brown people like 4-1 or 5-1 compared to white people. So it's just astounding the compounded impacts of people being in working in essential, so-called essential jobs, and living in overcrowded conditions, and having inadequate access to healthcare, and all this, you know, all this stuff suddenly is so starkly compounded in the form of these statistics, 5-1, 4-1. It's just, really quite something.
I was just going to say, that's really my main concern, is that a lot of reforms will be micromanaged. So you'll get people paying lip service to the crimes of slavery and an American racist supremacist history. You'll get the crumbs from the table for food banks and for outdoor relief or whatever's going to come out of this. So I think, for me, both the state and the political establishment and the corporate elite will just say whatever needs to be said and do whatever needs to be done on a limited basis just to keep a cap on this. But if you're correct in 30 million people becoming unemployed in the next two...
That's already happened. We're there now. That's where we're at now. 30 million... Yeah, okay. I mean, ultimately, they'll have to do something, right?
When those people have no money, and you have already 5 million people living on the streets, or probably 6
million. Yeah, right.
And yeah. There's a powder keg there just waiting to explode. If this was any other country in the world, the CIA and the Soros Foundations and the NGOs would be in provoking a militarized reaction from the protesters. A few people would be shot in the back, the government would be blamed, the police would be blamed, and you would have regime change. But obviously this that's done by America, not
well
done.
That could, you never know, it's a new I mean, but you got them sending out federal agents in the street to, you know, snatch people, so who knows. But it doesn't seem like Trump is such a lame fascist, though. He's such an incompetent fascist, such a completely narcissistic. I mean, it seems like he's trying to play by the fascist playbook, but he's really not executing things all that effectively. I don't know.
I think he's trying to be president rather than being president, if that makes any sense. And with the elections coming up in November, because he's a Republican, he's always going to push the law and order aspect of this. I mean, we hear 50 nights of rioting in Portland, but I've been watching it. It seems very choreographed to me. Almost like the riots that we had here. So people go down and protest. They make a lot of noise. that do a lot of shouting. The police response is clear the streets, this is illegal. And they're using, is it either stun grenades or flash grenades and tear gas canisters? And then they appear to move forward and the protesters appear to move back. And it's like a choreographed dance forward and back, yep. and back. And then some people end up getting arrested. So,
very familiar Belfast setting, kind of, you know, and including the boarded up buildings. And I mean, it's
the accents.
What's that? The accents are different.
Yeah. Are they actually deploying like rubber bullets, batting rounds?
And bean bags and pepper bags and right. But there's something else called a pepper bag and incredible amounts of tear gas and flashbangs and LRAD, these sound weapons. They've got something that looks like a green laser. I mean, I've seen pictures of it, but I don't know what it was. Like, what is this? It's only the federal agents have that one. That the local cops don't have whatever that is. And of course, they got their tasers. Yeah. Lots of rubber bullets, plastic, rubber coated steel bullets.
Yeah. I know the batting rounds that they used to deploy here, they're a good 70 mile an hour, something incredible.
And right.
The kill 1 in 15 and the injure 1 in 3, I think, are
right.
Statistics when they hit.
The statistics, yeah, there was something in, I don't know, some publication recently about the so-called less than lethal weaponry that they use here. And I think the statistics was from U.S. police departments. I'm not sure, but it was like 3% fatal, 15% total permanent injury.
Yeah,
that's not...
That's scary. Like
that's scary. Yeah,
the people who are unarmed and a peaceful protest. Like it's quite a vicious response. So nobody knows where this is going to go. There's no political representation for Black Lives Matter other than, I don't know, black representatives within the Democratic.
Well, no, Black Lives Matter. I mean, there are. It's an organization with a very eloquent spokespeople, women. And there's, so it's not, but it's not, they've been very,
rather than,
what's that?
They're like lobbyists or a pressure group rather than being.
No, I think there's so many different, people who with different agendas that would identify with the movement. And I think there's some confusion. And for me as well, as whether it's because it's partly an organization that was actually founded by specific people, but it's also become just like an idea, much like, industrial workers of the world or Students for a Democratic Society or even the IRA. So many different things. It's a mindset. It's a sort of way that people identify politically more than an actual organization, even though it's also an actual organization. But I think they've been, what's that?
It's a philosophy, I would imagine.
Yeah, and they have a lot of demands and a lot of perspective around history and how society is about mass incarceration and institutional racism and all sorts of stuff, but without necessarily being a political party in the sense of I think there's a lot of cynicism in that whole crowd about the political process because, as you say, I mean, Biden is a joke and he was behind the crime bill in 1996 or 94. And, it's well known at this point among many people, particularly among radicals and the black radicals and white radicals and all sorts of people, that this is, people like Biden are just part of the whole mass incarceration and imperialism problem, And when it comes to, in the Congress, the system's rigged. So if you're going to run for office, there's basically no chance for victory unless you're running under one of the two parties. But the most, there's definitely been an effort to try to take over the Democratic Party on the part of the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, which very much includes the, many prominent black and brown politicians like, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Presley and Ilhan Omar. There's some great, really good, I say radicals in the Congress, but there's just a handful of them. Like in the last military budget, it was like 100 out of the 435 representatives that voted against it. Mm. You know, so it had a supermajority, a veto-proof supermajority of bipartisan. But still, it's 100 that voted against it. So I think you could roughly say, you know, the efforts to sort of radicalize the Democratic Party have definitely failed, but there's more progressives than there were maybe 10 years ago.
Well, maybe they're sowing the seed going forward, you know, and maybe there'll be a new crop to grow out of that of real radicals who want to change. But I believe people who join the system, you know, they claim they're going to reform it, then they join it, then they become part of it, then they defend it, is my personal kind of experience.
I think that tends to be how it goes, and there needs to be protest in the street in a big way. You know, you need to make it financial. You need to be able to shut cities down. But if people are capable of that, of general strikes and that kind of thing, then anything is possible. You can make politicians do anything if you have that kind of power.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, that's great. I hope something comes out of the sacrifice of all the people, not just all the people who have been lynched by police brutality, but all those people who have protested, all the people who have been arrested, all the people
they're suffering terrible trauma, as you know. I mean, and really medical, serious medical problems, because as you know, being from Belfast, tear gas is really bad for you. You know, and breathing tear gas day after day is really bad for you. And I've been intentionally avoiding that myself, but I have been to a lot of protests in my life, including in ones that involved a lot of tear gas, and never more than 2 or 3 days on end of having, encountering a lot of tear gas. But I think even that, even just from one serious day of tear gas in Quebec City in 2000, I had a welt on my eye for 6 months after that. You know, I mean, it's chemical weapons. It's not fucking around.
And in the chest, I'm sure it leaves scar tissue.
Yeah.
If you're overexposed to it for any length of time. Okay, well, when you come on, when will we see you back? And God knows when we'll see you back.
Yeah, God knows, right? You ask the virus, you know. I'll come as soon as it's safe, you know. And then doing a tour is going to be another question, because what happens if the venues are only allowed to have 25% capacity or whatever, you know, that's not tenable for the venues or for the musicians. So who knows? I know. It's a mysterious future.
Unknown future in many, many, many respects. Well, listen, lovely chatting.
Great chatting with you.
So I'll tune in one of these evenings when you're doing your Monday night lockdown specials. It's just...
I'm not doing the open mics anymore on Mondays, but I'm still doing random interviews on other days, and I'll be doing other broadcasting though. Anyway.
I saw a band that are doing the Black Something Rising.
This Greek band, Bard Noir, doing a Black Flag Flying. Wonderful rendition. Yeah,
fantastic, man. Really. Proper rock and roll.
Yeah, but how are things in Belfast? What's the scene like with lockdown, with unemployment? Are you in Belfast now?
Yeah, or down North Belfast. Yeah,
yeah.
We've had the people reacted quicker than the government when it came to self isolation. People started to prevent their kids from going to school, because we could all. I mean, anyone who's all got the internet can read what was happening in China, what was happening in Spain, what was happening in Italy. And we were all frightened because we could just see this domino effect that it was coming our way. Then we had people from Ireland on holiday in Italy skiing. Italy became one of the epicenters in Europe initially of the COVID-19 virus. So those people brought it back here. So the government, the British government, Boris Johnson and the British Parliament at Westminster, we have devolved regional parliaments. So we have Stormont in the north, then there's a regional parliament in Scotland and one in Wales. But what happened was they wanted a national response. So our politicians got a get out of jail card, because they just waited to be told from Boris Johnson and the British Parliament what steps they were going to instigate and the timeline involvement. And I thought it was a disgrace that was political cowardice. I felt that we were all screaming, fuck sick, lock the place down. How many people you want to die? I mean, we have a population of around 2 million. And we've had something like 550 deaths, COVID-19, which kind of sounds okay, because we were talking about like 12, 14, 16,000. People thought it was like a plague. You were going to have people dying in the streets. But in reality, only 5% of the population here, 5% have been exposed.
Right.
So we had 600 deaths from 5%. When you multiply that by 20, all of a sudden you're hitting 12 or 13 or 14,000 people. So nursing homes, because of the age profile and the health, I think 40% of all our COVID-19 deaths have been in nursing homes of people over 65, really. So we went into lockdown and people were put on furlough, which is the same scheme that you might have alluded to earlier, where people are paid kind of to stay at home. Then the government's concerned about the economy, but that's only because the corporations and the capitalists will be saying to them, you know, here, we can't have this, we're not making money. And you potentially get a mass unemployment. In sectors like hospitality, I mean, Ireland's done very well the last decade, 20 years, excuse me, in tourism. And I suppose you have that economic cycle, the boom bust. So whenever the world is on a credit boom, people go on holiday, put it on their card, everything's roses in the garden. So it's devastated kind of the bar trade, the restaurants, the hotels, the theatres, the nightclubs, the cruise ships, everything that's associated. And then that has a spillover for taxi drivers and maybe private bus transport and a few other things. So we're slowly coming out of the lockdown, and that they're trying to get the kids back to school in September, but they're only going to go for 2 days. So like half school on Monday and Tuesday, then the school gets the food clean on the Wednesday, then Thursday, Friday, the other half of the school comes in. So for us, the older generation are worried about their personal health and safety. And for parents, they're concerned about the younger children, who are maybe beginning to miss out on that social aspect, the discipline of education, that social aspect of kids playing with other kids. But about 6 weeks ago, you could drive down the road when it was against, you know, COVID regulations to be doing that and see no cars on the road. And then 3 weeks ago, it's just like everything's back to normal. The shops are busy. They've reopened the bars. I was in the bar on Monday night watching the football match. First time I've been in a bar in months. Lots of people in there drinking, just not really caring. And some of the city centre bars that have reopened, it seems to be the young people who are not overreacting, but they're responding. They haven't been locked down and locked in. And they're all out kind of partying. But we're getting these wee spikes at different places. So one person gets it, and then there's a family, you know, people have a karaoke night, or there's a family celebration around a birthday or something. One person has it, gives it to 10 others, they take it home. So what they're trying to do is the R rate, if it stays below one, then they're going to allow people to continue as normal. And if it goes up one, like 1.3, 1.4 in different areas, they're going to have local, regionalized lockdowns. And they're going to do until they get either a vaccine or I don't know, to get the herd immunity, which I think part of this is about. Lockdown, ease the lockdown, more people get infected. Lockdown, ease the lockdown, more people get infected. Eventually you'll end up with herd immunity around 70%, but we've only 5% of people actually exposed. That's quite worrying.
Yeah, that's very interesting situation, huh?
It's same there then, is it? Very similar.
Yeah, except that I think most people haven't even heard of the reproduction rate of one. You know, I mean, if they've listened to BBC in the middle of the night or something, maybe they've heard about it because of Angela Merkel talking about it or something. But, you know, it's just a disaster here. I think most people just feel really confused and uninformed and don't know.
They're misinformed rather than uninformed.
Yeah, they're getting lots of different information from different places, and there's no systematic national plan, and that's a disaster because it's a nation, and there are no borders, and that, you know, people can go wherever they want, and it's spreading along the highway corridors. You know, you can see it like where it's spreading. There's a highway that goes from Florida to Maine, and it's, you know, spreading along the highway. Yeah.
assuming an arterial route, that's where people travel. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Diners, the rest stops for the truck drivers and
yeah. So, yeah.
Well, let's hope we're all here next year.
Yeah, and most of us will be anyway. Yeah.
Well, I'll go here. It's nearly 11 o'clock. So,
yeah, you get some sleep and I'll send you the MP4.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Farah. Great talking to you.
Bye bye.